Well, good evening, everyone. For those of you who are keeping track, this is evening number 3 on Romans, and God willing, we're going to do 2 more in the early part of the new year. You remember, I think it was back in early July, I decided, for reasons somewhat unknown, to start, at least to me then, to start off in chapter 7 instead of chapter 1. And I think I made some argument at the time for the reason why we wanted to start off in chapter 7, which is sort of not a normal way to look at a study. But it seemed to me that the most significant remark that Paul makes in this letter, and this is before I had a chance to get back in and read it again, and sometimes we conduct studies that way, it's not necessarily the best way to do it, but in chapter 7, verse 18, when he says, "I know that nothing good lives in me, no good thing. That is in me, there is no good thing." And it seemed to me that that was a very, very significant sort of turning point in this letter that he writes to the Romans. And then we went on to look at chapter 8 in the next presentation. And now I think it's best that we go back and do the introduction. Because the introduction in this sheet that we've had passed around, and if you haven't got one, I think Matt's got a couple of extra ones there. To go back and create some kind of context for this letter. Because from my first presentation that said, the most important thing that Paul said was, "In me that is in my flesh dwells no good thing," which was a remarkable thing. As we know, coming from a righteous Pharisee and a man with his background and his service to his Lord, to say something like that. Remarkable statement. But that was all within a context. First of all, we have to understand that this letter was written from Corinth. We're fairly sure of that. What we're a little bit less sure of is that it was delivered to Rome by this sister Phoebe, who you read about in chapter 16, and verse 1, who lived in a little town called Cenchrea, which was about 7 miles from Corinth. And I think it was on the east side of the isthmus. It was a port city. So Corinth was kind of occupying the middle, and then Cenchrea was one of the port cities on the edge of the of this channel that went through where Corinth was. She evidently, and there's no empirical biblical evidence that says that Phoebe carried this letter to Rome, but most scholars seem to think that she did. And I think we can probably go along with that. She probably, I might just add, and this maybe is sort of not part of this overall study, would have been very unhappy with what people are claiming of her today. With the sort of the sister speak movement, who are claiming that Phoebe is the sort of at the center of this concept that they were sisters who were deaconesses, which incidentally is not a Greek word, because the word here is male and masculine, and so therefore there's a bit of a problem with that in itself, but are trying to present Phoebe as being this sort of full service bishop type elder leader within the church in Corinth, which is simply not supportable from the text at all, nor is it supportable probably from the history of Corinth and the first century ecclesia. So I say that she would probably be fairly upset with what claims are being made of her. She was a servant, and she served Paul. She was one of the many sisters in the first century who supported the ministry, who were benefactors of the ministry. There were those with Christ as well, of course, who supported the ministry, who gave their houses and their substance. Many of them, like Lydia, were business people, were people who were probably indentured servants or slaves, but were fairly high-ranking trading people and business people within the context of that Roman society. Anyway, that's beside the point. There was, about this time, slightly before this time, an exile of the Jews from Rome. Was it Augustus Caesar who kicked the Jews out of Rome? And the edict lasted for 4 years, and then was rescinded, I believe, by Nero. Now, you can straighten me out on this because I didn't bother writing the details down, and I've that's beyond me. But the fact is that there was a four-year period where the Jews, which would have been Christian Jews and Jews, were kicked out of Rome. So the believers that would have been left in Rome would have been primarily Gentiles, and that might be a bit of a speculation, but it's probably quite true. But right about the time Paul writes this letter, there were Jews moving back into Rome. Now, this was a place to be for business. It was the center of the empire, and there was lots of things to do in Rome. So there were a whole bunch of people moving back in. Now, the list in chapter 16, where he mentions, I think, 28 different names, and that's not probably fair to say 28, because there was a bunch of other implications in terms of names in the last chapter, in chapter 16. But these people who were he was greeting now were people who most likely had moved back in. Some of them were Gentiles who were there, but many of them would have been, like Priscilla and Aquila, for example, who were probably moving back into Rome, and Paul knew these people. So Paul had a vision, and his vision was to use the city of Rome to be a bridgehead to take the gospel to the western part of the Roman Empire. Now, we know that because in chapter 15, if you go to verse 19, chapter 15, verse 19, by the power of signs and miracles through the power of the Spirit, so from Jerusalem, he says, all the way around to Ariculum. And Ariculum probably corresponds to today's Balkan states, maybe Albania, maybe Yugoslavia. So this word Ariculum really indicates to us that Paul's preaching, his ground ministry, went right through the northern part of Greece, Macedonia, and into the Balkans. And he said he'd been there and done that. This is a remarkable thing because the man was 56 or 57 years of age. He was for all intents and purposes, worn out. He'd already presented, he'd had this long list of trials and tribulations he'd been through. But here he was saying to the brethren and sisters in Rome, I'm going to come through there and I'm going to go to Spain because I've done all of the Grecian part of the eastern part of the Roman Empire. So this is a huge statement on Paul's part. It's just most remarkable. The final greetings are an indication of sort of building a network in the city of Rome for this very thing to take place. And we know that he spent 2 years there in his own hired house, which was part of this vision that he had. Now, I want to say, from my own personal observations of this letter, that the letter to the Romans is the most comprehensive, systematic presentation of the gospel of Jesus Christ that exists. Now, that might be a big statement, but I think it is absolutely true. If you wanted to take the gospel to the world, especially the world in Paul's day, how would you present it? What would you tell the people? Now, think about the context of Paul's visits and his travels. In practically every city he went to a synagogue first. So it was his response to go to the Jew first and then to the Gentile. And he built his ecclesias from synagogues. And so the model of the first century ecclesia was basically a synagogue model. And it's not talked about specifically, but I think there's a clear assumption that that's what happened. They went to the synagogues. The Jews from the synagogue who accepted Christ moved out and took a structure, a building structure, a formal meeting structure out with them. So what would you tell the world? The Jews first, and then the Gentiles, if you were to summarize it and say, this is what I have to tell you. This is what you take to the world around you. It would be the book of Romans. It would be the letter of Romans. So let's have a look at the introduction. Chapter 1 has the normal kind of greetings that Paul would normally give to any in the beginning of any of his letters. Not only that, there were thanksgivings and sort of words of mutual encouragement down to about verse 17. And then, and we referred to this last time, he puts his message, his thesis, in a nutshell by saying in verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew and second for the Gentile. So you say, well, what was it all about? What was Paul's preaching all about? What was all this business about going from town to town and spending 30 years of his life trekking up the streets and Roman roads and taking this message out? What was it all about? It was about the gospel that was the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. The Jew first, and also to the Gentile. Now, once you've said that, of course, you've got to put some more words to it. You've got to put some more argument to it. You've got to kind of flesh it out. And you have to say, well, who needs salvation anyway? What's salvation all about? Who cares about salvation? And why do we need salvation? Well, we need salvation, he says, because of sin. Now, in chapter 1, verse 18, through to the end of chapter 4, he systematically goes through this issue of sin, first of all by saying that the Jews had no corner on righteousness. They had a sin of their own. So the Jews couldn't say, well, we don't have to worry about salvation because we are the Jews and we have the law and we have this history and so on, and so therefore don't look at us. Paul says, no. The Jews are sinners first and foremost for some reasons that we could have a look at later. Then, of course, the Gentiles, it was clearly understood, had a problem with sin. So further to that, of course, there was the problem of universal sin. And let's go to chapter 3 and verse 10. Or verse 9. This is the conclusion then. As he goes through God's righteous judgment, he goes through the Jews and the law, he goes through the business of Gentile sinners. He says in verse 9, what shall we conclude then? Are we any better? Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. So this is a universal problem of sin. And there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, in verse 11, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. All have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. So what are you going to do with that? You have to realize that the world needs to be saved from sin. Sin is a universal malady. There's no one righteous, not even one. And where is salvation then? It is through faith, through the righteousness that comes through faith, through what we would call the justification by faith. Now, we know that Martin Luther, evidently, was a Catholic a priest, got into reading Romans, and he concluded, as the story goes, that there were some problems with the kind of works righteousness, legal aspect of the Catholic Church, and that salvation really was not through those types of works, but it was through faith and faith alone. And so his reasonings came from Romans and this concept of justification through faith. As he elaborates this thesis, he, of course, brings forward the argument of Abraham. Now, this Abraham's a very good argument here because Abraham kind of preceded the Jewish nation. Abraham was there as a righteous person before the law came along, because the Jews would always argue the law. So Paul would say, okay, but before the law, Abraham was righteous. And what was he? Well, he was this faithful man of patriarch who came from Babylon and moved out and followed and did what God asked him to do, and he believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So now the good thing about Abraham is that the Jews could have Abraham, but so could the Gentiles. Because Abraham didn't sort of come from that lineage. He began this thing, and he defined what faith really was. So he has to go to that example in chapter 4 and say, okay, we are saved from this problem of sin through faith, and that faith is in God, believing God. And as a good example of that, we can have a look at Abraham. So once you're justified by faith and belief, there are, of course, consequences to that. In chapter 5, verse 1, is a very good introduction to that, because Paul, as I think we said before, has it in front of these paragraphs that are actually, you know, we should forget the verses because they create quite a bit of a problem. But the paragraphs that Paul writes are begun with these phrases, chapter 5, verse 1, when he says, therefore. So if you've been justified by faith and now you have entered into a relationship with God and you're now saved from sin, you got to do some things. Because you've been now justified by faith and you have peace with God, therefore you've got to start looking in a different direction. You've got to start living a different life. You've got to start doing different things. And again, we talked about these sort of connecting words, chapter 4, verse 16, therefore the promises, chapter 5, verse 1, therefore since we have been justified through faith, verse 6 of chapter 5, you see, he says, and he builds these points up, chapter 5, verse 12, therefore just as sin entered the world, verse 18, consequently, and I'm reading from the NIV, but these words are all there, basically, connecting chapter 6, verse 1, he says, what shall we say then? So, once we've been justified by faith, the result of that is that we've got to have a different life, and we've got to start to look to the heavens, basically. And then, of course, as part of the process of this justification and change, there's the issue of baptism, which follows nicely in chapter 6. The response to sin is belief in God changing our life and being baptized, chapter 6. And then in chapter 7, we start a process which I'm going to call, from a biblical point of view, and I'm not going to make any excuses for this, because I think this is where we're at in chapter 7 and 8, the process of sanctification through the Spirit. So we understand sin, we respond to sin with faith and belief in a living God who can save us. We change our lives, we get baptized, and then in our lives there begins a process. It's a process that we're going to call sanctification through the Spirit. Now this is actually a biblical term, and we're doing the readings a week ago, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 13. Paul mentions this just almost offhand to the Thessalonican ecclesia when he talks about the sanctification through the Spirit. We can accept God and the reality and the power of God to change our life. We can accept sin as we should, identify it and reject it in our lives. The consequence of that is that there is a change in our life where the whole way that we think is different, the things that we do is different. We're baptized as an expression of that change that takes place in our life, and then begins this process that we call sanctification through the Spirit. Now, we won't get into that because we were looking at that last week from chapter 8, verse 11, chapter 8. If the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead is living in you, He who raised Jesus from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through the Spirit who lives in you. So really, salvation at the end is through the process of the Spirit of God living in our hearts. That's how eventually we achieve salvation. And he goes on to say a whole bunch of very positive things in Romans chapter 8 about that. Now, having said that to the Jews, and also to the Gentiles, somebody's going to say, yeah, but Jesus was a Jew, and the hope that we're talking about is the hope of Israel, and Paul spent, again, 2 years in his own hired house saying that it was for the hope of Israel that he was bound with these chains. So if we're saved through faith, if we're sanctified through the Spirit, and that the hope is in Jesus Christ, then what about the Jews? Which is chapter 9. What about the status of Israel today? And that was a very, very important question, because Paul spoke again to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. The Jewish synagogue was foundational to the spread and the advancement of the gospel of Jesus Christ in the first century. So what about the Jews? Well, Paul said he had, a great sorrow for the Jews. He was a Jew himself. He wished that he could be cursed. If he could say, this is this confession, beginning of verse 9, if he could say, I'll give up my life, my eternal salvation, for my nation Israel, I'd do it gladly. That's how much he felt about Israel. There's a couple of things that we need to remember about Israel, and they needed to remember about Israel as well. Israel basically hadn't done a very good job of being God's witnesses. As a matter of fact, in chapter 10 that we read, he says that the Jews had gone about, and I actually can't see the verse that I'm looking for here, verse 3 of chapter 10, since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God, the Jews, and sought to establish their own. And that's probably the best way you could summarize the whole issue of the nation of Israel and the faith of Israel. We'll get back to that in a moment. But that was the problem. They had decided to do their own thing and write their own stuff, basically. So we don't like that, and here we're going to add these laws to this, and we come up with this thing called Judaism and so on. And that was the thing that killed them. So that was one of the problems. The other problem was that God, who is the creator, has a sovereign choice. And a lot of the time we argue this and debate it and say, well, how come Israel had all of this punishment? How come Israel had all of these blessings? Why didn't other people have it? And so on. We have to understand, brothers and sisters, that this book that we call the Bible wasn't written to you and I. It was written to Israel. Basically, it was written to the Jews. It's a book of Jewish history about Jewish faith. It does extend to the Jewish Messiah and goes to the Gentiles, because it was to the Jew first and then to the Gentiles. But we have to understand that God, who created the earth, has a sovereign choice. And he said at some time that it was Israel that was going to be his light-bearing nation. So whether they liked it or not, that's the way it was. He said to Abraham, I'll make your seed a great nation. And that's the way it was. And that was God's sovereign choice to do that. He could say, well, by the way, I think I'll have Jacob instead of Esau, which is what he's arguing in chapter 9. He could say, well, I've decided that this guy Pharaoh is going to be a bad actor, and he's going to suffer a lot because of it, and he doesn't have any choice. And people say, well, why did God put that into, how did he make Pharaoh do that and suffer? Well, because God has a sovereign choice to do that. And we don't have any right, nor did the people in Paul's day have any right to debate that and say, well, that's not fair. God also has a sovereign choice in verse 25 of chapter 9 through the prophet Hosea, who says, I will call my people who are not my people. So God also has a sovereign choice to say, and by the way, I want my gospel to go to the Gentiles, to all the world. So That's the situation with Israel. And in verse 33, he laid in Zion a stone that causes men to stumble, a rock that causes them to fall, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. And that rock was Jesus Christ, and that was a stumbling block to Israel. And in verse 29, unless, as Isaiah said, unless God had left Israel a small remnant, they wouldn't be around. So it was God's sovereign choice to preserve them. So having said that Israel was there because God decided that Israel was going to be there and not the descendants of Ishmael, the descendants of Esau. Having understood that regardless of Israel's response, God had made this sovereign choice, and therefore he was going to preserve the nation of Israel, is the great miracle that ties the scriptures together from Abraham to Paul sitting in his own hired house in Rome. Having understood that as God had the sovereign choice to choose Israel, he also now had the sovereign choice to say to Paul, go out and speak and teach to the Gentiles. So, chapter 10. My heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel, the Israelites, is that they may be saved. And the problem was that they were a very zealous bunch of people, verse 2. But their zealousness was not based upon an understanding of the simple truth of Messiah. What were all those sacrifices about? What were all those feast days about? What were all those sacrificial worship services about? What was that history about in Israel? Well, what they'd done was they'd missed the boat, basically, because they didn't want what God had presented to them in sacrifice. He presented it in Abraham, he presented it in Isaac, he's presented it in Jacob, he presented it in through the priesthood. They really didn't want that response to sin. So what they did, they decided to, as I say, write their own stuff. Now, if you have a Bible like I do that lists the references, the cross-references, not the cross-references, but the actual quotes from the Old Testament. Now, most of yours list them in the margin. It's a little harder to see them. They're there, but they're in the margin. In my Bible, they're just right across the bottom. So I can look at the bottom of chapter 10, the page, and see a dozen quotes from the Old Testament. And if I look across, just scan across, most of them come from Isaiah. Paul quotes 57 times from the Old Testament in the book of Romans. So when he said it was for the Jew first and then to the Gentile, when he said it was for the hope of Israel, he was bound by these chains, he quoted the Old Testament, but primarily he quotes Isaiah. Now, if you just do a little bit of a numbers game here and see how many times did he quote from Isaiah, how many times? Isaiah was number one. I think Deuteronomy is number two. I think the Psalms are number three. And after that, there's a bit of Exodus. There's some Malachi. There's some Hosea, Genesis, a smattering of other Old Testament references. Primarily, he quotes from Isaiah. Now, what I find to be remarkable here is that he doesn't quote from Jeremiah. There's no direct quote that I can see in the letter to Jeremiah. But in chapter 10, there certainly is a strong implication to Jeremiah 23. And we just have to spend a few moments in Jeremiah 23. If you'll turn with me there. When we think about this business of establishing their own righteousness, which was the wrong righteousness, it wasn't a saving righteousness. And in terms of establishing your own righteousness and missing the boat, basically, of the real righteousness, you really see that in Jeremiah chapter 23. Now, first of all, we look at verse 25. I have heard what the prophets say who prophesy lies in my name. They say, I had a dream, I had a dream. How long will this continue in the hearts of these lying prophets who prophesy the delusions of their own mind? So what was going on in Jeremiah's day and many of the prophets' day was that they were getting the wrong stuff. They were listening to the wrong people. They were listening to the false prophets who were telling them lies, basically, things that they wanted to hear. They were just basically ignoring what the prophets of God were saying, and they were looking at delusions of their own minds. Well, first of all, you had the prophets who were doing that. And verse 27, they think the dreams they tell one another will make my people forget my name, just as their fathers forgot my name through Baal worship. Let the prophet who has a dream tell his dream, but let the one who has my word speak it faithfully. For what has straw to do with grain, declares the Lord, and so on. And if you read through Jeremiah 29, you'll see that there was two problems. One was that there were false prophets who were just telling straight out lies, who were saying that the nation was not going to be judged by God, that everything was okay, and that the people were basically buying into that. And the people were saying, well, that sounds like good stuff. And Jeremiah, of course, ended up in the dungeon. So on the one hand, in Jeremiah 23, they had their own righteousness, as Paul says in chapter 10 of Romans. They sought to establish their own righteousness by listening to the wrong people and writing their own stuff. Well, Jeremiah 23 starts with verse 1, saying, woe to the shepherds who are destroying and scattering the sheep of my pasture, and giving them the wrong information. What was the real hope of Israel? Verse 5 of Jeremiah 23, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land. In his days, Judah will be saved, and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. So there was a righteousness. The Jews had decided to come up with their own righteousness, which put them in the same death spiral as the Gentiles, because the Jews' righteousness was their own righteousness that had no more saving power than anything the Gentiles had. But what did have saving power in Israel was the king who will reign wisely, the righteous branch of David, whose name will be the Lord our righteousness. So that was the right righteousness. What they listened to from their prophets was the wrong righteousness. So, verse 3 of chapter 10. Now again, he doesn't quote from Jeremiah here, but clearly this is what's behind this. Verse 3, since they did not know the righteousness that comes from God and sought to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. Verse 4, Christ is the end of the law so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. You see, Jeremiah 23, the Lord our righteousness, this is where it's at. Was in Jesus Christ, and they'd missed that by writing their own stuff and listening to their own false prophets. Now Moses, in verse 5, describes it in this way. The righteousness that is by the law, the man who does these things will live by them. But the righteousness that is by faith says, do not say in your heart who will ascend into heaven, that is to bring Christ down, or who will descend into the deep, that is to bring Christ up from the dead. But what does it say? What it does say, the word of righteousness says this, the word is near you. That is the word of faith we are proclaiming. That if you confess with your mouth, Jesus is Lord. This is Jeremiah 23, brothers and sisters, the Lord our righteousness. This was the basis of salvation from the very beginning. And it was what the Jews had missed. If you confess with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. That's the right righteousness. That's the right basis of righteousness. It's not in the law. It's not in their stuff. It's in Jesus Christ. And that is who Jeremiah was talking about and all the prophets were talking about. And that is not a response to some type of works righteousness or temple sacrifice or keeping of new moons or feast days or Sabbaths or shedding the blood of animals. That is because the word is in us, in your heart. And if we confess that with our mouth, Jesus is Lord, and believe in our heart that God raised him from the dead, that is the basis of salvation. For it is with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it is with your mouth that you confess and are saved. And that really is what he's talking about in the justification of faith, as is Abraham, and the confession of baptism in chapter 6. So these are patterns that he's bringing through to us. Verse 11, the scripture says, everyone who trusts in him will never be put to shame. For there's no difference between Jew and Gentile. The same Lord is Lord of all and richly blesses all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That is Isaiah 52, verse 7. Now, having said that everyone is confined to sin and committed to sin, there's no one righteous. And that the only way for salvation is through an acceptance of Jesus Christ as Lord and a confession of that with the mouth and a belief in the heart. And that there is no other salvation, there is no other name under heaven whereby men may be saved. If that is true, and that is what I believe to be true, and whoever calls on the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, as he's just said, who confesses with their mouth that Jesus is Lord, will be saved. If everyone who does that, and that is the only way to be saved, then the question in verse 14 is, how then can they call on the one who they've not believed in? So how could you be saved by calling on the name of the Lord, but nobody taught you about the Lord? You didn't know about him. And how can they believe, in verse 14, in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear, and this is the point, without a preacher? So when Jesus said, go into all the world and preach the gospel, how are people going to know about Jesus? How are people going to know about this saving faith, either a Jew or a Gentile, unless they had a preacher? Now that is an awesome responsibility upon all of us. And let me make it personal here. Because there are people who are dying in their sins because there's nobody to preach to them. How can they hear without somebody preaching to them? And we say, oh, well, I'm not a preacher. I'm not a preacher. That's what somebody else does. They're preachers, right? Well, I want you to come with me to Acts chapter 6. Paul knew what he was talking about here when he says to the Romans and to us, how will anybody hear without a preacher? What you need is a really good preacher to preach to you and teach you about Jesus Christ, because there's no other way you're going to be saved. And so in Acts chapter 6, at the beginning of the chapter, there were some apostles who were chosen to wait on tables. Now, I love this because there was these apostles, and there was there were lists. Some of them are listed there. There were some complaints from, remember, the Grecian Jews and some of the Arabic speaking community, because their widows were being overlooked in the daily administration. So some folks in the ecclesia were dropping, sort of falling through the cracks. So they chose seven men from among them who were full of the Spirit and wisdom, and they turned this ministry over to them. This was looking after the widows and the orphans and the administration of sort of the welfare portfolio within the ecclesia. And one of those was Philip, and one of those was Stephen. Now, when the Jews rose up in this sort of mob response to the preaching of Christ, they didn't seize one of the big guys. They seized Stephen. They didn't go after Peter or one of the big-time preaching apostles who were out on the street. They chose this apostle who was waiting on tables. Now, Paul was there. We know Paul was there because in verse 8 and 9, there were some Jews from Cilicia and Asia and Cyrene and Alexandria, and Paul was from up in that area. And Paul was, of course, in the end of chapter 7, receiving the clothes of the guys that were stoning Stephen, were laying the clothes down at Paul's feet. So Paul was there, mentioned in this group. And in chapter 6, verse 10. And verse 9, they began to argue with Stephen after they'd seized him and brought him into this kind of kangaroo court. But they could not stand up against his wisdom or the spirit by which he spoke. Now that's a remarkable statement, because this was not their preaching brother. This was not the great orator. This was the brother who was waiting on tables. This was a real slap in the face to Pharisees like Saul of Tarshish. Because what he got and what they got was a really, really good history lesson in chapter 7. The best bit of preaching that they probably ever heard in terms of the history of Israel. And not only that, there was a personal call to action at the end of chapter 7. And as Paul was standing there, viewing this whole thing take place, this whole thing come down, with Stephen now being stoned and the heavens opened, and Stephen looking up and saying in verse 60 of chapter 7, "Lord, do not hold the sin against them," and then falling peacefully asleep, Paul, brethren and sisters, had a preacher. And I think when we understand what Paul was saying, there was no one that had preached the message of Jesus Christ and the history of Israel and the Messiah better than Stephen. Now, it doesn't say that Paul's saying, and by the way, but we know that because he was there. We know that when Paul says, "How can they hear without somebody preaching to them?" Paul had a preacher and he knew what he was talking about. And by the way, in verse 15 of chapter 10 of Romans, how can they preach unless they are sent? Now, the problem was in Jeremiah 23 that these false prophets were coming along and preaching all the stuff that people wanted to hear, but they weren't sent. They were kind of populist preachers who were probably getting paid or whatever to make the people happy. They weren't sent. Jeremiah was. Stephen was sent. He was full of this Holy Spirit and the Word. There's no sense just having a preacher. You need to have somebody who's sent, Paul says. And by the way, it is written, Isaiah 52, verse 7, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Stephen, yes. What a wonderful thing that is. But not all Israelites accepted the good news in verse 16. For Isaiah says, Lord, and again he quotes Isaiah, something like, there's 57 Old Testament verses, and 60 to 70% of those are from Isaiah, right throughout the whole letter. Isaiah says in verse 16, Lord, who has believed our message? Consequently, faith comes from hearing the message, and the message is heard through the word of Christ. And how did they hear? Well, of course, they did hear, because their voice in verse 18 has gone out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. And that was the message that Paul was taking out now, the message of faith in Jesus Christ. That was the power of God unto salvation for the Jew first and also to the Gentile. And to take out this wonderful message, he said, we just need preachers, because otherwise how are people going to hear this message. And what we need, brethren and sisters, is our best preachers to go out and take this message. And our best preachers are our preachers who have sacrificed lives. Our best preachers are not necessarily what we think of as our best preachers. Our best preachers are our sacrificed lives, our servants to Christ, lives lived by the Spirit of Christ, whose faces are like angels, like Stephen's, who live forgiven lives, who can slip to their knees and cry out, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them, even in the face of death." These are the preachers that the Lord needs, brethren and sisters, and that is how this wonderful message will get out. Well, chapter 11, what about Israel? God has not cast off his people. Verse 5 of chapter 11, so too now at the present time, there is a remnant. That is a great miracle of Israel and of the grace of God in preserving this miracle in our day. So too at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace, and if by grace, it is no longer by works, and if it were grace, no longer... If it were works, then grace would no longer be grace. God has preserved a remnant. He's preserved ingrafted branches into this vine, this tree of Israel. The Gentiles were brought in. The foundation of this faith was in Israel, in the remnant of Israel, and in the grafting in of the branches of the Gentiles. And if their rejection in verse 15 is the reconciliation of the world, which was the, I suppose we could say, the crucifixion of their Lord, and that was the turning of the official turning to the Gentiles, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? And that is a wonderful hope that we have, the hope of Israel. Verse 25, I do not want you to be ignorant of this mystery, brothers, so that you may not be conceited. There was this smugness that Israel had. He said, don't be that way. Israel has experienced a hardening in part until the number of Gentiles has come in. And God has determined and set apart a number of Gentiles. I think this is what this means. God has preserved a remnant of Gentiles too, that aren't saved because of works, but are saved by grace, because they've been called to be saved. And when that number is made up, God knows when that number will be made up. We don't. But when that number is made up, then all Israel will be saved. That is when the great climax of the ages will be. And the deliverer, in verse 26, will come from Zion and will turn godlessness away from Jacob, and this is my covenant with them when I take away their sins, he says. And so, as far as the gospel is concerned, they are enemies on your account, the Jews, but as far as election is concerned, they are loved on account of the patriarchs, for God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. There is a day coming soon, brothers and sisters, when the number of Gentiles will be made up, and then the Gentiles who are part of that remnant in Israel will be saved with the deliverer coming to Zion. He concludes this section in verse 30 with this doxology. And this is an expression of awe, really, when you think about it. The power of God unto salvation from the Jew first and also to the Gentile. Oh, the depth of the riches of the wisdom of God, in verse 33, and knowledge of God. How unsearchable his judgments and his paths beyond tracing out. Who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen.